Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here for episode number 444. In just a moment, I'll be sharing with you a conversation I had with Sensei Koshin Paley Ellison, who is the co-founder of the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. And we have a deep and beautiful conversation about lots of issues around end of life, but particularly the need for contemplation and deep presence as we sit with suffering and support one another through the end of life. And it's a lovely conversation. I think you'll really enjoy this one. It's been something I've wanted to do for a long time, to have a chance to talk to Koshin. And he's also the author or co-editor of the book, Awake at the Bedside, Contemplative Teachings on Palliative and End-of-Life Care, which is a book I have long admired. So stay tuned for that. Just a couple of really quick announcements. I want to remind you, I have some gift guides on my website, which I didn't get those out in time for Christmas last year, but I have created them now, and they're gifts that would be appropriate for someone who is receiving care, someone who is a caregiver, or someone who is grieving. And I put a lot of time and thought into picking out some gifts that might be appropriate to give. If you know someone in one of those circumstances, maybe you have an upcoming event. We have Mother's Day coming up, Easter, Father's Day, and always anniversaries and birthdays, a time when you'd like to give someone a gift and you're not exactly sure what to get, check out the gift guides. They may give you some inspiration and you'll think of some ideas. So go to the show notes for this episode, and it's at eolupodcast.com. Look for episode 444. Down below in the links, you'll find a link to the page of gift guides, and you can just check it out, see if anything there moves you or gives you an idea of something you might want to give to someone you care about. And next, I want to thank my latest supporters on Patreon, Michelle Wickham and Robin Bissell. Thank you so very much for your generous donations. It's so greatly appreciated, and I really thank you for helping to support the podcast and my YouTube channel. It also means everything to me emotionally and spiritually, because it tells me that there are people out there listening who appreciate the content that I'm creating, the work I'm putting into it, and would like to see this podcast continue. So thank you so much, Michelle and Robin, and also thank you to all of the people who for the last several years have been making contributions on my Patreon page at patreon.com/EOLU. And also those of you who have been buying me coffees and making donations through PayPal. You're changing everything for me. I really appreciate it. It means everything. And I'll also remind, though, those of you who've joined my community on that Patreon page, we're coming up on the end of the month when, over the next few days, you'll receive the end-of-life news update for the month, which I curate every month for my patrons. And then also March 1st, you'll receive the What to Watch guide, a list of some programming on the streaming networks and the major television networks that you can watch to help support creators who are making content that focuses on end-of-life issues, death, grief, the afterlife, all of those topics, because we want to support the content to ensure that more of it gets created in the future. So I just have been putting together a list each month to help you discover some interesting things you might tune into and watch over the coming month. So now we'll move on with my conversation with Sensei Koshin Paley Ellison. I'll come back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I am so delighted to welcome my special guest, Sensei Koshin Paley Ellison. Koshin is an author, Zen teacher, and Jungian psychotherapist. After many years as a chaplain and therapist, Koshin co-founded the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care, which offers contemplative approaches to care through education, personal caregiving, and Zen practice. Today, New York Zen Center's methodologies are internationally recognized and have touched the lives of tens of thousands of individuals. Koshin is a world-renowned thought leader in contemplative care. He is the author of Untangled, Walking the Eightfold Path to Clarity, Courage, and Compassion, Wholehearted, Slow Down, Help Out, Wake Up, and the co-editor of Awake at the Bedside, Contemplative Teachings on Palliative and End-of-Life Care, which is how I became familiar with Koshin a number of years ago through that book. His work has been featured in the New York Times, PBS, CBS Sunday Morning, and Tricycle, among other publications. And you can learn more at the website zencare.org. And Koshin, is such an honor for me to welcome you here because, as I said, I've been following your work for a number of years. And this is like something I've always wanted, to have a chance to just sit down and talk with you. So I'm grateful you're able to be here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a joy to be here. And you know, it was really sweet to, you know, Awake at the Bedside to me is like such an incredible book that I enjoy a lot myself regularly. And so it's just always sweet to hear it.
Yeah, just the other day I went back and I reread all the poems from Awake at the Bedside. There's such an amazing collection of poetry in that book. And I think, and you mentioned, it really is the perfect book to have at the bedside if you're sitting with someone, because the poems are short. Everyone has a few moments when they can just sit down and read a poem that's so evocative, so deep and touching. And these poems have a way of saying exactly the right thing.
Yeah, that's amazing. I still regularly get these incredibly sweet notes about people saying that they're sitting there with their mother or their father or their partner or their child and just reading it, and as they're literally at the bedside. And it's, to me, the most beautiful thing that we can do in this life is offer something that's useful. So it always is, feels very joyful. Yeah,
that's so true. So Awake at the Bedside, Contemplative Teachings on Palliative and End-of-Life Care. I'll just recommend it again because it's one of those resource books that if you're in hospice or you're a death doula or wherever you practice, or even for your personal use, it's nice to have on the bookshelf because there will be a time when you will need this book and you'll be glad you have it.
Generous.
Well, in the book, Koshin, you mention a story that I'm hoping you'll retell us about caring for your own grandmother as she was reaching the end of her life. And I'd just love to have you tell us a bit about that story and then how that influenced the work you're doing today, the work with your own grandmother.
Yeah. Well, I think in order for me to tell that story today, I need to just tell a very brief story, so that when I was a teenager, I grew up in the 80s, the 1980s. And
that previous century.
Not the 1880s, not the 1880s. But which was the beginning of the AIDS pandemic, and even before we knew what that was. And so I was a teenager and preteen during that time. And some of our closest family friends, people I called uncle, in particular Jerry and Michael, we became very sick. And this is the time when they would call it like gay cancer or something like that. And so visiting them in the hospital became super ordinary, because who didn't love them? And we'd go and eat, you know, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, or you just hang out with them. And then, you know, at that time, they were covered in Kaposi sarcoma, and people may or may not remember that time, but it was a time when people walked around like skeletons and really were just dying so quickly. And it was really through being with them, and they were so lovely and warm and loving and hilarious, That, just hearing the staff outside the door, clearly people were afraid of the disease at that time, and people would say terrible things about them, about, basically that they deserved it, or they, were sinners, or so just really seeing, and I experienced a lot of confusion, like, well, why would you be saying that about someone that is just so amazing, and so clearly they hadn't taken the time to get to know them. And so that for me is a important it was such an important learning, about how we can be cruel or afraid when we're not opening into curiosity and not understanding how much we don't know, And this is also then a fast forwarding about 10 years in my around 25 when I was around 25 years old. And my grandma and I were so tight, and she was like one of those rare human beings that when she was looking at you, she wasn't looking anywhere else. And when she was listening to you, she was not listening to some background noise in her brain. She was just completely there and nowhere else. And her husband died, and soon after his death, my father, who was her son and her daughter, my father was living in Syracuse and his sister was living in Atlanta, wanted her then to move to one of those places to an assisted living. And she was actually working full time at that time,
Wow.
running a very busy law office in Midtown Manhattan. And she loved it. And the people who worked in this office loved her, And when she couldn't do the stairs on the subway anymore, they started sending a car for her back and forth. She was just this bedrock pillar of that place. And she was like, move. She's like, I'm not moving anywhere. She's like, I have my beauty parlor, I have my community, I have my diner, I have, all the different things that she was embedded in community. And so one day we went for a walk together and we sat on the bench and she took my hand in hers and we made a pact to care for each other. And she's like, I'll care for you and you care for me and we'll do it together. And it'll be a deal. And so we sealed it. We, interlaced our hands together and we said, okay, we're going to do this. And so, from grocery shopping to ambulance rides to doctor's visits to emergency room visits, as our aging, if we age and don't have a sudden death, it goes like that very often. And at a certain point, she, moved into hospice care because her systems were just doing what they naturally do. They were just coming to the end of her life. And she had a sister, Rose, who was in a nursing home, and she's like, I'm not doing that. Not doing that. And she saw how unhappy her sister was, and not that there's couldn't be something wonderful about being a nursing home, but that was not what she wanted. And it was also not what her sister wanted. And humbling, And so we moved together into the hospice unit, and for so the those 6 weeks of being together, I learned so much with her and really seeing, in particular, on one hand, how afraid most people are of just being ordinary. That death is actually super ordinary. Even our aging is ordinary, our breakdown and illness is ordinary. It is will happen to everyone. And from really super well-meaning people, like family members and friends, and people would just come and just almost like as if they could, if they were at the foot of the bed, embracing their hands on the foot of the bed, that could save them from death. Like if they didn't get too close. And even many of the staff in the hospice were also very busy. And she said, they all need to slow down, even though they have a lot to do. But are they really here? And you can be, she's like a bee, a bee is very attentive, even though it's very busy doing a lot of things, but it's in this flower. And now I'm somewhere else. And so it's very amazing to see that this woman who lived her life with filled with curiosity was dying in her dying process with curiosity and compassion, really saying, like, wow, it just they're all so well-meaning and they don't know how to connect. And it was really amazing to just be with her. And during that time, many of us from our Zen center were coming to be with her. And she loved that because the Zen people, she would call them the Zens. She's like, when the Zens come, they just come and sit down. We talk, or we're quiet. We read something, or we don't. She's like, there's something wonderful and ordinary about it. And then, right near the time of her death, actually about 2 days before, she woke me up in the night and was shaking me. I was sleeping in the bed with her. And I was always actually very nervous about that because she was so tiny. She was like a little bird, little fern at that time. And she woke me up and she's like, I'm so sorry. She was streaming with tears. She said, I'm so sorry. I'm like, what are you sorry about? And she said, I didn't love you fully. And I remember feeling so stunned by that because I had never felt so loved. And she said, there was this little part of my heart that contracted from you because of the Zens. And she was a she's Jewish, and from her family mostly were died in Holocaust related things or pogroms. And so she was very very ethnically oriented as a Jew, but was not religious. But she felt still felt like it was a betrayal of her family, that I was betraying the family in a certain way. And then she's like, and I'm so sorry. She's like, that was such a crazy idea. Because she said, that part of you that I didn't understand and retracted from is exactly the part of you that has brought us so close. And she said, and now in my 87th year, I'm finally learning a bit about love. And what does it mean to love someone fully?
Wow, that is so powerful that the revelation, and then that you had the openness and the curiosity to be there with her at that, at the age you were, to make that choice was amazing, but completely life-changing, I would imagine.
Yes, and really, like the next day, Chodo, who is my husband now, she said, I've got to tell you guys something. It's like the day before she died. She's like, I never thought I'd say this, but there's something to the Zens and how to care for people. And she's like, the two of you need to create some sort of nonprofit organization to teach people about the Zen and how to care. She's like, because you actually seem to know how to care fully and to love fully in the most ordinary, fearless way. And you can teach other people and encourage them.
I love that she saw that and that she was able to give you that message. That's incredible.
Amazing. And so, people often attribute Chodo and I as the founders of this place, the New York Zen Center, but it's really Mimi Schwartz, this 4'10" Hungarian immigrant who she it was her idea. Like, we were just like decent listeners, and to really receive, like, wow, that is a really good idea, and that could be super helpful and meaningful and caring. So it was amazing to. So then, oh, just one. Is that okay? Just one more
Yeah,
second.
keep going.
My God, I love her so much. So the next morning, she had told me a few weeks before she died that when the time came that she would need me to leave the room. She said, because I'll never go while you're here, because it'll be too unbearable. So I'm going to ask you to go when the time comes. And there are many other funny stories about her assuming when the time came. But on June 23rd, about 8 in the morning, it was a Sunday morning, and yeah, she woke me up and said, "You need to go to and get the New York Times, the Sunday Times, and get yourself a little breakfast and sit in the park." It was a beautiful day, beautiful morning, clear, sunny. And there's a park right outside where we were. And she said, "You just read the paper." And we just looked at each other and cried and held each other for the last time in this way.
Wow. And you knew because she'd prepared you for it that this was the time.
And told each other how much we loved each other and said goodbye. And so I sat outside trying to read the paper, feeling the sun on my face. And about 20 minutes later, the nurse, whose name's Cookie, and Cookie called and said, she's gone. So yeah, we went upstairs, and I called Chodo and another friend, and we washed her body, cared for her in that way. In some ways, the Jewish tradition is thought to be the highest mitzvah, that so the person can't thank you, but it's also incredibly riveting to just because she was not there anymore. And it's like, wow, the body that carried her, we could take care of that. But it was amazing how, true that was.
Wow.
Yeah, so I still feel that in many ways that my life of vow and living by vow is, learning how to learn from all the other Mimis of the world and caring for the Mimis of the world. So I feel her deeply present with me every day. I offer incense to her every
It that is just that's so beautiful and so touching, and I loved how she recognized, and you did as well, that there was something missing in the healthcare system and in the medical workers that came to attend to her, which is, I think, one of the biggest problems we have today in Western medicine, is that there is not a contemplative practice within medicine. It's all about intellect and thinking, and there isn't time for silence and quiet and sitting and presence.
Yeah. And I think that it's just really the more you stop and reflect, the more I stop and reflect, the more things feel clearer. Yeah. And then the more possibilities there are, and more curiosity, and like what's actually helpful. What's actually, you know, and a few years, you know, after we, you know, we have both been ordained as Zen Buddhist monks and thought we should need more training. So we did chaplaincy training, and both of us are trained as psychoanalysts. And so we have a lot of different training, and but we also felt that there was just endless need to train and learn, which I still feel, still want. I think of myself primarily as a student, and when appropriate, I teach. But I often just really appreciate that, you know, what we've learned is actually that we all need a lot of help, and what is most needed is a supportive environment. Like, we don't feel like we need many more training programs just for training programs' sake. It's like, what is everything for? Like, I'm doing this for what? And so, for the sake of what? You know, so, you know, when we started the New York Zen Center, we really thought, well, the official title of it is called the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. So that's a mouthful. But in our mind, always, it's for care. So the measure of our life is how well are we caring for people? And particularly like the people in our immediate life. Like, are you engaged in relationships with your barista, with your, if you live with people or not, or with your neighbors or people that you see occasionally? You know, I feel like that's always how you treat waiters. I always find that super interesting. How do you treat people who are caring for you? Yeah.
Yeah. And connecting with your community, wherever you are, whoever happens to be part of your community in your day-to-day life.
Yes.
Yeah, and our society nowadays, it's challenging to actually get people to slow down, as you said, and just take their time and be more mindful. There's a lot going on, and people have lots of responsibilities, and everyone is rushing around and busy, like you described in the hospice.
Everywhere. It's like, it's just, you know, even in slow places, people are running, you know. it's amazing. And so how do we, you know, remind each other? You know, one of the words that has been translated as mindfulness, called sati, and in Sanskrit, in very, now it's a very popular word, mindfulness, and mindful medicine, mindful everything, right? And which is, you know, good to slow down and be attentive to things. But one of the other translations of that word is to remember, which actually I find a bit more helpful. It's like, am I remembering? Am I functioning with my values? Am I functioning with even how I'm thinking about myself as I wake up, and how I'm thinking about my connection to the world? You know, like, how am I remembering what's most important. And as I make my way through time of the day, am I actually putting in effort to live according to my values? It's a really important question, you know. And to me, it's, you know, as you know, and through your work, and through probably most people who are listening, we know in some way, maybe through the experience of death, is that regrets are always about what was I doing?
Yeah, exactly. What was I not remembering at that time?
Exactly. And you know, the Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, who was just a guy, you know, or, you know, and we live in that kind of more misogynistic world, so it could have been a woman, who knows, but like just a person, and could have been named Karen or Goshen or so on. They're just a person with a name. And we really saw that, you know, we are. Our only true belonging is our action. That we're all subject to aging, to illness, to death. And our actions are the only ground on which we stand. So, like, what we do, so, like, I'm always encouraging myself. How are you feeling your day? Even if you're at work, and many people, you know, apparently like 85% of people do not enjoy what they do for work. But how are you inside of that? You know, are you just like, we're finding a way to find something to pay attention to and care about? And why wait until you receive some diagnosis? As is very common, you know, people really receive a diagnosis and they're like, oh no. To me, the key part is trying to remember that the diagnosis is that you're born. The life
Ultimately, yes.
is finite. And it's not a nihilistic thing, as you know. And it's like it's what makes life amazing. Like we have this like one opportunity, as far as we know.
Yeah, and just being motivated to make the most of that opportunity and take in every moment of it.
Yes.
Well, I know that you created the Contemplative Medicine Fellowship, which is a 1-year program, and I would love to hear about that. What inspired you to create it, what it consists of, and you've also done a study on the outcome of it. So
Yes.
if you would tell us more about that, I'd like to share that with our listeners.
Beautiful. Yeah, so early on, about 22 years ago, we started working with a man named Russ Portnoy, who is a palliative care physician, and a woman named Diane Weyer, who is also a palliative care physician and geriatrician, and dear friends of ours. And they both were like, the two of you, like, I'll have what you're having. It's like that when Sarah and Harry met Sally. They both said, like, we'll have what you're having. And so we started working with them and teaching with them. And so we started doing physician education about 20 something years ago. And in small ways, from Grand Rounds to then join the faculty of a number of medical schools and then teaching abroad, also in Japan. And what was heartbreaking is always, you know, since we are monks, we're sort of in a unique position in a certain way where people often like confess to us. You know, it's just how it is, you know, just like, you know, and mostly people were talking about how exhausted they were. And this is years ago, before they were like really talking about physician burnout and really everyone becoming more aware of the rates of suicide and drug and alcohol abuse and divorce and just deep, I mean, burnout doesn't even quite cover it, right? And
Yeah,
now
that's
there was
true.
that study last year where that, maybe I think 40% of physicians are planning to leave the profession in the next 3 to 5 years. Yeah, so we're in this wave of time where things are completely, in many ways, just broken. And people would come to us and confess, like, oh, I'm so bad at my self-care. I'm really bad at my self-care. I know I should, do yoga or meditate or, it's like always about doing something. Take 5 minutes or whatever that is. And then, about 5 or 6 years ago, it changed where, like, I'm so bad at my self-compassion, because that became more
That,
like the popularized thing. And, we thought, gee, there's a common denominator there. It's just that everyone is so lonely, so isolated. And then the medicine that they're given is self-care and self-compassion, like to even segment themselves even more. So painful. And then they feel terrible about themselves because they're not achieving. So, I mean, we just thought, let's just pause and really reflect on what would be actually helpful. One of the things that we've been always doing since we started, almost 20 years ago, is, again, the world doesn't need more training programs. So our foundations and contemplative care training and our Zen training and our commit to Zen, all of our different things that we offer are community focused. Getting to know people and finding your people. So, like, many people actually, people have gotten married in our programs, people like are very connected and find some like deep friendships. For us, finding good spiritual friends is the whole thing, So we thought, well, if we're going to do something for physicians, because we deeply care about them, and they've always come, physicians and nurse practitioners and physician assistants have always come to our trainings and never found enough of a cohort of, it's such a specific group, right? And there's a specific suffering, and the others can't share in a certain way. And so we thought, like, let's create an amazing fellowship, which is, part of the medical view, but actually make it about fellowship.
Not just using the word, but
Not
actually
using the
doing it.
word. So reclaiming. So we thought, like, these three words were part of the medicine itself, which is contemplation. So how do we pause? How do we remember? How do we get into mindfulness, into our reality? And how do we actually remember and say, gee, what actually is medicinal? What is the medicine I need inside of me, in my relationships, and in my clinical work? And how do I find my people, who are also concerned about this and actually looking to do something new, something fresh? And so we created this contemplative medicine fellowship for doctors and nurse practitioners and physician assistants to. And that's built on the Four Noble Truths, which is the nobility that we all suffer, and we have to honor that, and that there are causes, and we can change, and there's a path. That's essentially what it's about. And then we thought, well, let's, so it's this year-long training. That is so, and we gather together once a month to really experientially learn and practice. And so we're not, there's no didactics, those are all videos. And then twice a month on Wednesday evenings, we have all of these amazing friends, and that's like Danny Goldman and Dan Harris and Trudy Goodman and all of these different Buddhist teachers, as well as Diane Meyer and different other amazing physicians who come in, and longtime friends, to be in conversation. So like we'll have one tonight where we're going to meet and actually just talk. Let's have a group conversation about this. And so it's very, very beautiful to think about pedagogy in what's actually needed. And so, as we know that, we live in a medical world where research is sort of like the new God. And so, of course, we did research on, we're in our third cohort now. And the first cohort, we had this research study, and then it was written up and just accepted in a peer-reviewed medical journal. It'll be published. It's already online, which is so wonderful. And to really think about, like, yes, it's really important for people to understand that we also speak their language, that this is not a woo-woo thing. This is actually, how do you get some integrity into who you are inside of yourself? How do you tend to that? How do you tend to your relationships? And how can you work in your clinical work differently? And how do we support each other ongoing in an amazing way so that we can feel cared for and caring equally? And it's just been exquisite to see this happening. So what you don't see in the study is the human beings. And actually, what was beautiful in the study that actually came out, that most people reported feeling increased joy in their lives. So it's not just preventing burnout, which it does, but actually more joy, and who doesn't want that?
Yeah, to be able to experience joy in the midst of suffering and in the midst of sorrow, because that was such a missing piece in all of our medical training. And in fact, even having a framework for understanding suffering and what that is, to only be told your job is to eliminate it. And we have these drugs and we have surgeries and we have treatments you can use, and that's how you get rid of suffering. But never did we even understand what suffering really was, or what it was about. And we were missing all the depth of it completely. And that's what and made it end up seeming like such an empty practice. And I think that some burnout comes from there. There's just not enough depth to the tools we're given to use with patients.
Yes. And I think that we also think that we still are all under this fantasy that there's a work-life balance. And we're like deconstructing that also, because you only have, as far as we know, you only have one life. And, I still remember one of our fellows who's very involved with it, also like all the fellows pretty much are still connected on their WhatsApp groups. And also we have a monthly gathering for them from even from 3 years ago. But one of them came in, and she came into the interview, and she was, very high functioning leader in her major medical center, leading a fellowship and a residency program. we know, like, and then going home at the end of the day, long days, of course, after writing into the electronic medical record, she described crawling home and having nothing for her two little girls and her husband. And for her to feel there was something terribly wrong, and how out of whack that is. And to hear her, now 3 years out, feeling so much joy and really loving medicine in a totally different way, and loving the medicine of having a l lived and integrated life,
I love that
and having
integrated.
good friends.
Yeah, that's really amazing. And it seems, I mean, when you talk about it, it seems like these are simple concepts in a way. We just bring people together and we help them share authentically and really look at themselves and understand what it is that they actually wanted for their lives, because I'm sure what she opened her eyes and saw, I'm not living the life that I wanted to live. And she could still do all the same work, but just by learning how to be present, she could feel like this is now the life. This I am living what I wanted to live.
It's
It's
so
amazing.
beautiful.
Yeah. It's so amazing. And that you're able to help people get to that place, by bringing them together, it sounds like. I mean, it sounds like it happens almost organically. People come together and you create the scenario in which they can interact with one another and connect, and it happens.
I think it does, and the container is super important, and it's kind of, it reminds me in some ways, because the book that I felt so moved by the first year that I writing about the Four Noble Truths became of deep interest to me, because I felt that the fellows were doing this work of really looking at their stuff. And I really wanted to look at my own suffering and my own causes of suffering and my own capacity and many attempts and failures and joys of change and my own path. And so that's actually, so I think that there also, what I experience is that this not just showing up, but also a dedication to saying, I want to actually move into the unknown. And I want to move into what I don't know, which to me is like most of reality.
If we're honest about it, that's for sure.
I often, we go to Mexico for couple weeks each year, and there you can see a lot of the night sky, and even on places where you can see a lot of the sky is only like, I think it's 5% of the stars that are in this, in the Milky Way galaxy.
Wow. That's
So
incredible.
I love that, just like looking out at that and the inspiration of that, just like, ah, oh, that canopy. And just to realize that even that, which looks like a crazy amount, is only 5%. And so then the hubris of thinking we know anything.
So true.
The, to me, that's also joy, which to me is also like what this beautiful work you're doing is like about bringing the conversation around death and dying. Like, because I think that we don't actually understand death. We don't, nobody knows what happens after. Tons of theories, tons of stories, but no clear reports, as far as I know. So it's like that, to allow the deep factual mystery. Like it's a fact, like it's just like, it's
It
mysterious.
is mysterious. And then, I mean, it seems to me there is laughter inside of that revelation when you first realize it, because you th look back and think, how much of my time have I spent trying to explain the mystery? And all along, I wasn't acknowledging it's just a mystery and I'll never explain it.
Yes. It's really, and it's so relaxing. And I think it's very interesting, the work around psychedelics and, around people who are dying. And they, what they report, I'm not so familiar with that research and the practice of it, but I'm aware of it. But I think what's interesting is actually it's ties to what we're talking about, like that people are experiencing, like, oh my goodness, like I'm part of this vast mystery. Like that's what they realize. And that's a deeply like anti-anxiety medication. Like, because it's not even a medication, it's just, well, it's medicine, right? It's like a medicine that, like, oh, to realize we're just a speck in this thing, and yet we're part of the canopy, is an amazing thing.
It's so beautiful. And therefore, why worry about these things that are outside of our control and that we have no influence over? Why worry about that when we could actually be using that energy for something else?
I remember my grandma one night, she woke me up and she said, I'm going into the great eye. I said, what is she's like, where there's no separation. The great eye. She's like, it's not me. It's like that same, and she was not in her life of a particularly mystical person, but she just was really curious about watching her mind and how she was beginning to, things are getting a little thin between that protection that we often coat ourselves with about what we think and what we're afraid of and what we mostly fear. Yeah, and our opinions.
But it kind of reminds me of when a friend of mine was dying a few years ago, the day before she died, she whispered to me, "I'm dissolving and it's beautiful." And that actually gave me so much comfort, that image, and to even imagine it will be okay to dissolve at the end, it will be okay for as I dissolve and I get assimilated into whatever else this greatness is, the great energy of life and the universe and creation.
Yes, one, it reminds me so much of this story that Chodo often tells of the salt boy. And there's, this parable of the salt boy, and so he's walking around and he doesn't feel like he's like anybody else, and doesn't know where he belongs. And one day he goes to the sea and he's sitting on the beach and looking out and feeling sad. And then he gets hot and goes into the water and he starts to dissolve because he's made of salt. And then just as he's about to completely dissolve, he's like, now I know what I am.
I love that. That ties in beautifully with that
Isn't it?
image I have in my mind from her.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's why you made me think of that. It's
Yeah.
beautiful.
Yeah, that is. Well, I was wondering, you mentioned a practice at the beginning, the practice of remembering, which I love, and I'm going to take that. I'm going to remember that and take that with me because that it's just so powerful to think, am I remembering the things that need to be remembered, the important things? But are there any other practices? I know this is, I don't know, off the cuff, but just for us non-Buddhists, practices that similar to that may help us remember better, or help us in our day-to-day lives, or help with our grief. and our fear.
Yeah, well, I'm very grateful for my editor, Nana. So, like, she in the book Untangled, which is really for anybody. It's not a Buddhist book per se, Nana. But there are lots of practices in there for grief and for investigation and contemplation. And one of them is a kind of a guided practice of looking at the cage that is the size of your own body that we often are keeping ourselves in.
Wow.
And for me, that was a I've discovered my cage while I was writing this book. And I found that part of me, like the front of the cage was open, but the sides and the back were, I was still inside of it, not leaving it. And to really reflect on, like, what is that you are? It may look like a defense, because I think that the front of mine used to be closed too. It was like other people couldn't necessarily see it unless they really paid attention. But I was really, it was almost like an armor, but also like a cage, you know? And where does your defensiveness and fear? To me, this is always a question I ask myself, you know, like where am I feeling defensive, or am I feeling fearful or anxious? And how is that actually impacting how I relate to the world? And to me, it's about the only way to do these kinds of reflections is very tenderly and lovingly, you know. So it's not about like, oh, see, I'm so screwed up. Like, we're all screwed up. We don't need more of that. But we, you know, to really reflect on, like, wow, how do I nourish my imprisonment, and how can I nourish my freedom, you know? And where is the space between those things? And just to be, you know, some of us like writing or talking out loud. It's a great conversation to have with someone that you really know well and feel adventurous with, and to really help one another to get a bit clearer, a bit more pizzazz.
I love that image too, because I may have opened the front of my cage, but there's so much more to it. So I can't stop there and think, look, I've done this great work. I opened the cage, but it's still there, and I need to be able to keep looking at it.
Yeah, it's just to me the beauty of humility. It's just like, ah. Endless opportunities to learn.
So very true. Life itself is that, but then every one of our experiences, and I mean, which makes me think of just, I had no idea this hour of talking with you would turn it into like this beautiful opportunity for me of a container where we could share and go deep. And it's been so lovely to hear your stories, but and your wisdom, but also to just feel your presence and your willingness to slow down and just be here and be real with everything.
Well, I felt like you invited it. I feel very invited.
That's good. That's very good. Well, of course I want this to go on and on for hours. It's been really wonderful. I can only imagine what being part of the fellowship would be like. Something that even, those of us who spent most of our lives in medicine, we are just hungry for that, for this kind of interchange and this kind of connection. It's been so very missing in our work. And so I'm really grateful that you've created the fellowship, and people can learn about it on the website.
Yeah, it's zencare.org, yeah. Or just Google Contemplative Medicine Fellowship and you'll find it, you know. Yeah.
Because you have a new cohort coming up.
In July we'll begin, yeah.
Okay. So if people are interested, there's a chance to get in while it's open and become part of probably the most amazing transformative year of anyone's life, I would guess.
That's consistently what the fellows say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Koshin, just for being present with me. Very lovely, and I can't imagine a better conversation with you. So I'm really grateful for your presence and that we got a chance to connect today.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a deep pleasure to be with you.
Yeah. Yes, very, very nice. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Koshin. It was very deeply inspiring and moving for me to talk with him, and I hope that you felt the same as well. I loved hearing his story of caring for his grandma Mimi and how that inspired him not only to work with people at the end of life, but also along with Chodo to create the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. And I'm also so very excited about their 1 year contemplative medicine fellowship. If I had it to do over again, if it were available back in the day when I was active in hospice and palliative care, this fellowship would have been exactly what I was looking for. And so, if you're someone in that situation who might benefit from it, please take a look at the website zencare.org, and there will be a tab there where you can read all about the Contemplative Medicine Fellowship and see if it's something that might benefit you as well. And I'm thrilled to know that it's there and so happy to recommend it and spread the word to colleagues who might really benefit from this special training and just coming together with other providers in such a deep and meaningful way. So if you enjoy content like this, I hope you'll share the podcast with other people who might like to listen and might benefit from it. And also make sure you subscribe and leave a rating and review wherever you happen to listen, because that helps us rise up in the ranks and the algorithms so that when people are searching for content like this, they're more likely to be able to find it. And if you're interested in joining my Patreon page or supporting the podcast by buying me a coffee or donating on PayPal, you can go to this link, eoluniversity.com/support. There you'll find all three of those ways to make a contribution. You just click on the link and you'll be able to easily make a contribution there. If you're interested, thanks in advance if you choose to do that. So I will be back next week with another new interview for you. It will be time for me to host Barbara Carnes once again, my recurring guest. And Barbara and I are going to talk about grief and bereavement in the hospice setting. So I think that's going to be a really powerful conversation for the two of us to have. So until then, remember, we're here for love. That is really what this life is all about. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings you next, and love each and every moment of your very precious life. Bye-bye.